Best Energy with naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise. We have learned from Einstein's theories that matter and energy are one. Physicists believe that all systems in nature have their own particular way of vibrating. From the swing of a pendulum to the waves in the ocean to the light that brightens the sky each day, each of these oscillates at its own unique rate. In the same way, things such as rocks and minerals vibrate very slowly and at speeds that are imperceptible to us. Living things such as plants, animals, and man vibrate faster and appear to be alive. The same holds true for every thought, feeling, event, or word we speak. Each has its own frequency or rate of vibration. What many of us don't realize is if we take everything in our own universe down to its simplest form, it is all just energy. Join Dr. Rita as she explores questions such as, what are we made of? Why do we get sick? How can I live a more balanced and whole life? Call in and talk to her and her thought-provoking guests. Send us your questions and get the help you need to move beyond any obstacles or challenges that may be affecting your life, right from the source. So stay tuned and explore your possibility.
Hello and welcome to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and thank you all for tuning into the show today. We're going to have a great show. We're going to be talking about the greatest story ever sold, the Christ Conspiracy. But before we bring our guest on today, let's talk a little bit about our new feature, our Mind Yoga Question of the Week. Last week we asked a question, and actually the question was, what was the earliest recorded crop circle depiction? And we did not have anybody, no one knew the answer. So we're going to talk about that a little bit after the next break. And then a little bit later on the show, we're going to have a new mind yoga question for the week. And the first person who writes in, sends an email to justenergyradio@yahoo.com, will win a copy of Haunted Spaces and Sacred Places. And everybody, yes, that means you too, everybody that enters the contest, whether you have the right answer or not, will go into a random drawing and could win a free psychic reading brought to you by the Institute of Applied Energetics. So let me tell you a little bit about our guest, because I have a feeling we have a lot to talk about. Okay, pushing too many buttons here. So my guest today, her name is Acharya. I have to, you know, that phonics thing with me, it's Acharya. And let me tell you a little bit about her. In her various books, Acharya describes the New Testament as a work of mythic fiction within a historical setting. She claims that the story of Jesus Christ is a retelling of various pagan myths representing astrotheology, or the story of the sun, and also incorporates the science of archaeoastronomy. She asserts the pagan understood the stories to be myths, but Christians obliterated evidence to the contrary by destroying and controlling literature when they obtained control by the Roman Empire, which led to widespread illiteracy, probably the Dark Ages, in the ancient world, ensuring the mythical nature of Christ's story was hidden. Ooh, sounds interesting. Anyway, welcome to Just Energy Radio, Acharya. Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. It's nice to be here. That was a very good summary.
Well, I am just I'm just so excited to have you here. It's like I got your book and I started reading right away because it's a little hefty. There's a lot to read there, but it was really good. Interesting. It presented a perspective about Christianity that I had, one, never thought about, and two, never even thought that there was any kind of documentation in any way, shape, or form to the contrary of the Bible. But we are going to get into that in depth because I have you for 2 hours. Yay.
Yes, this is an unusually long show. I haven't done a couple hour shows in a few years, but I have done many radio shows over the years, and some of them have been quite interesting indeed.
I don't think we will have a lack for things to talk about. Anyway, how did you get into this whole, why did you decide to write this book? And I mean, I know a lot of your work kind of, you know, circles around topics like this. How did you get here? in the first place?
These are great questions. I think people will be very interested in a little background, a biographical material that has led me to the point where I'm at now, which is now we're going on 20 years of me writing specifically about this particular subject of Christianity as a mythical rehash. So I've been online for since 1995. I have put this original article up that I wrote about this subject. But if we start going back before that period, you can see kind of how all of this started coalescing in my being. How I was like almost born to do this. Just even from childhood, there were markers of where this was going to come out eventually, and really interesting to look at these things in retrospect, because I go, aha, that's why I'm like this, and that's why I brought this along with me wherever I came from. So, for example, I'll give you a lovely story I like to tell, because it's just so innocent, and people can understand that I was a baby once, you know. I was an innocent person. Some people think that everything I'm coming from some horrible, you know, the believers wonder if I'm, you know, she's in league with Lucifer or something ridiculous like that, when in fact I'm just an innocent observer on planet Earth. And one of the stories I like to tell is that when I was about 2 years old, I remember toddling across my yard. We had a lovely green expanse when I was a young child. And in the back, there was a man digging in a hole. And this hole was pretty significant. It was over his head, and it was large. So I remember waltzing out there, toddling, I should say, out to the edge of this hole and asking this man, what doing? And he looked up at me and was just so amazed at this small child there. He told me, showed me that he was digging bottles out of the ground that had been buried outside of an old bottle factory that was about 100 years old. So he started pulling these lovely, shiny, beautiful, colored and shaped bottles out of the ground. Some of them were like the head of George Washington and like a Liberty Bell, and just really exciting stuff that was from history and kind of old. And so this experience kind of just like gelled. Hey, you can dig in the ground and find treasure. You know, this was like a huge, huge revelation to me. So I spent years digging in the ground looking for treasure everywhere in my yard. I mean, I didn't like big holes that annoyed my family or anything, but I would just poke a stick in the ground. And I was off in the forest, too, and I was always looking for things buried under the ground. So this eventually, of course, led me to become extremely interested in archaeology, which I eventually studied and pursued in Greece, which is a great place to be studying archaeology and actually digging. I did dig in the ground eventually and find some really cool treasures in Greece. But that prompted that kind of interest. And then I was also like handed books of Greek mythology. I remember coloring books and colorful pictures of Greek gods and goddesses. That goddess part is pretty important because it's been completely obliterated in our modern religions. So I had this background in National Geographics too. We had stacks of National Geographics in our private, you know, personal home library. So I was exposed to all these wild cultures and fascinating, colorful civilizations all over the world, dating back thousands of years to the present time. So all of this was a very expansive perspective of reality that I got as a child. And the myths are important because, in a sense, I was inoculated against believing ridiculous claims with no evidence, you know. So, because I was told, these are stories, these are myths, these are the same stories that you're reading in your Disney books. I mean, there's no difference between the myths in the sense that they don't take place on planet Earth. They're actually fictional tales. So I knew. You have stories in Greece of a god who lives up in the mountains and is throwing thunderbolts and lightning at people and having relationships with mortal women and giving birth to who subsequently give birth to demigods and superhuman saviors. So I'm already reading this stuff, and of course at the same time, I was born into a Protestant Christian family. My mother's side of the family goes back to 1630, arriving in this country. And these were Puritans who coming from England. So this is a long lineage of Christian heritage in my family. And 1630 is traceable actually back to the 13th century with Eleanor of Aquitaine and King Henry II. So in any event, this, it's like I didn't fall off of a passing meteorite. I'm actually a very long Christian heritage familial line here. So I know this. We were taken to church on a regular basis. I was baptized. It was a very respectable church, Congregationalist church. My mother had been a Baptist after the whole Puritan episode of her ancestors. She goes into become a Baptist, and then she found that to be too harsh, so she became a Congregationalist Protestant, which was very mild. It's like Little House on the Prairie stuff, very mild. No hellfire, brimstone, nothing tortured me, nothing bad to, make me, this is not a, my investigation is not a reaction against abuse that I suffered. It's just pure fascination, innocence, curiosity, and something that my mind is geared towards that led me to these conclusions. And so all of these factors are pointing to the road where I would end up, which was, I did get really bored with church when I was a kid. Even Sunday school was unpleasant to me. But the playground was fun. I remember that part. But
recess.
We had a wonderful playground. But sitting in the pews, why did they call them that? I don't know. But sitting in the pews in church, listening to the minister, who was a perfectly lovely man. We loved their family. We used to hang around with them. They were friends with my parents. Very nice people. But seeing that, it was just such a bore. Why do I care about this culture from, they say 5,000 years ago, but obviously we know archaeologically that's not true. But well, I'm sitting there and I'm snoring. It's like out of the Monty Python movie, Meaning of Life, where so did he take his tent peg down to Gilead? And you're like, what? Who cares? Tell me about the stories about, Greek gods flying around and doing all these crazy things. I'm much more interested.
They were much more, yeah. The other gods were much, they're always fighting with each other and, going around each other's back, and it's like cursing people because they looked at each other nasty. It's like, ha, ha, ha. Well, I mean, one of my favorite of all-time movies is Jason and the Argonauts, and I'm sure you've
Absolutely.
Seen that movie 500 times. And I love how they, take the different humans and use them like chess pieces. It's like, we'll just get rid of this guy.
Oh, yeah, that's Clash of the Titans. Yeah, the Clash of the Titans has just been released again. That was a great movie with Harry Hamlin. That kind of stuff. And you actually go to that country and you start going around and seeing all these fantastic ruins with such great architectural designs. And it's just an amazing culture. And I got tuned into that. At the same time as I was falling away from Christianity as a child, I was being exposed also to people like Dr. Louis Leakey, who's the great anthropologist, and talking about ancient Gary, we're digging in the ground again, looking for skeletons. And also just the Greek culture was eventually ended up when I was a young teenager ended up in Greece, and so it was seeing all these sites. I just decided at that point what I was going to study. I said this is what I want to study. I looked at the Temple of Olympian Zeus in Athens, and I was just like, and the Parthenon, and I'm like, this is so fascinating to me. Plus, also around that same time too, I was being taught about the American founding fathers and how great the American Constitution is, and these incredible people like Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin and so forth. That these individuals who were so widely esteemed had studied Greek civilization. They had studied what are called the classics. They had studied Roman civilization as well, but the Greek was focused on as being the originators of democracy and all kinds of enlightening ideas in the Western world. So it was all coming together like that. And I eventually ended up in college studying Greek civilization, classics, and getting a degree in that, and then going to Greece a number of times and spending time digging there as a member of the American School of Classical Studies. at Athens. So, you know, getting a good dose of this heritage, and also then that leads me to that allowed me to read and speak. I could actually speak modern Greek pretty well, but read ancient Greek, which, of course, we know is the language of the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So, all of these factors. Also, being in Greece too, I was exposed to centuries of Greek Orthodox Christianity, which is really quite disturbing. For example, in the monasteries, their main focus on, they had paintings all over the walls, and it was all about torturing, martyrdom, being tortured to death, being cut into pieces, being flayed alive, being boiled in pots. Seriously, these are pictures on the walls of the monastery. So this is what you do. You go into a monastery to contemplate, and that's what you have to be surrounded by. So it was all, at that point, when I was studying there for several years in my 20s, that was starting to really make me sick. I mean, on the one hand, have all this wonderful art, golden mosaics on the ceilings of churches and cathedrals, which were so beautiful and everything. But
and then boiling people.
Yeah, then yeah. So you look up at the Christ Pantocrator, who's supposed to be the all creator God, on the ceiling, and then down below on the lower levels are his followers being cut it, sawed in pieces, and it's like, what is this disconnect here? This is just sick. So that was a turnoff. And at that some point, then I started getting more involved in reading about and studying other religions, the Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, yoga, and looking at concepts of enlightenment and Satori Samadhi, all these ideas, and seeing the contrast between different religions and how some are definitely life-affirming and others are focused on death and torture and martyrdom. And then throwing in all the ancient Greek mythology and the Roman mythology, and then, of course, I learned about mythology of other cultures, such as the Indian and many others around the world. And that's it in a nutshell, how I ended up where
I am. That's your story, and you're sticking to it.
It all came about in quite an innocent, open manner where I was open to other cultures. And when you actually do that, are exposed to other cultures, such as either in antiquity or in modern times, you tend to be, especially if you can learn the language, that which gets you right into the mind of the people, you tend not to be... You can't be like culturally biased, like, oh, this book here contains the truth, and if you don't believe it, then you're all evil, and everybody outside of this book is evil. So all these cultures are despicable and disgusting. They were trying to say everything that came before Christianity was evil and of the devil and all this garbage, and I knew that, having actually dug in it and lived there in Greece, for example, and knowing that the American founding fathers were aficionados of, we call them Philhellenics, aficionados of Greece, then I knew that this was wrong, just wrong, and I couldn't go along with it. And
so you're just trying to set the record straight, which is cool.
Well, I can't go along with such nonsense, trying to tell me that pre-Christian cultures are all evil. And then this is a total disgrace and disservice to my genetic heritage, which is European, and saying that all my ancestors were following the devil and so and such forth. This is, there was a Viking king or someone who said, you're telling me that my ancestors in Valhalla are all in hell? I reject your religion. And so
I have to tell you, I have the exact same experience. I went to Catholic school, and in second grade, we were doing, sacraments, because, we did communion in second grade. And my mom is Catholic, my dad is Jewish. And so when we were sitting there talking about baptism, they said, well, if you're not baptized, you go to limbo.
Yeah, right.
And I was so angry and so upset. I mean, I was really upset because, one, I wasn't given a choice to be baptized. Two, it meant that, like, my grandma, you know, my grandpa, my cousins, which I could live without, you know, yeah, the Jewish side, were all going into limbo. And I had no choice. And basically, you can't, like, undo baptism, you know, quote unquote, if you know what I mean. And I just was, like, not a happy girl and started questioning everything. So I totally hear where you're coming from because it's a joke. Let's get into a little. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say another great mentor, muse of mine. I've just finished publishing a book of hers. Barbara Walker was telling us in her book talks about how her minister said that her dog would not. Her dog had just died, and the minister said, "Well, I'm sorry, but there'll be no dogs in heaven." And so she said, "Well, to heck with your heaven, then. I'm going with my dog." And that was kind of like her awakening at that point. Was, you know, I mean, it reminded me of a story of this woman, this friend of mine who was a Catholic, and she was telling me, she's getting on in years, and she was in pain, and she said, "Well, I just can't wait to die and go to heaven to meet my Jesus." And I said to her, "Well, that would be my hell." She became very, very upset and threw a couple of epithets at me. But, I mean, my point there was that what they have depicted, sitting on a cloud and singing songs at the feet of the giant man in white robes for all eternity, is not my idea of heaven. So, you know, this is...
Well, I just figured the party is going to be in the other place, and, you know, that's where me and most of my friends are going to be. But let's kind of turn our attention to... there was a comment in the chat room. When are they going to get to the meat? Like, okay, here's some corned beef on rye.
You're going to get
oh, trust me, I got plenty of juice here.
You know, some people actually like the background of biographical material, so it's different.
I mean, basically, and I'm just going to kind of lay a little piece of groundwork here. I mean, basically, what we're going to be talking about is the basis of Christianity and whether there is any factual basis in Christianity. So that's kind of our groundwork. And so this is the first question I would like to throw out there. I mean, we are introduced to Jesus in the New Testament, you know, obviously in the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Weren't these books historical documents of his life? I mean, weren't they supposedly written by the apostles about their experiences hanging out with Jesus, partying with him?
Well, sure, that's the impression given. First of all, I like not to call these documents because they're not, by the strict standards of documentation, these are not very well done. But you have to know that the Orthodox claim is that only two of them were direct apostles or disciples of Jesus, and that would be Matthew and John. And then Mark and Luke are just kind of repeating hearsay. And so, but then if you know that Mark is, I don't think Mark is the first one, but I think Mark is the first text. So just let's say for Mark, for interests here, we can call it Mark, that if this is the first gospel, which is a very common mainstream perspective, and yet this guy wasn't anywhere around at the time, then the other one's copied from him. You know, it's like, why would Matthew, who's supposed to be a close eyewitness, be copying from a guy who wasn't even there? And same thing with, Luke copies too, but Luke is not supposed to have been around Jesus either. So John's book is so off the wall and so patently late in its language and the concepts it depicts that it's very difficult to make that claim, too, that this had something to do with the guy who was actually there and watching the story. So all of these claims start to fall apart when you look really closely. From the outside, if you want to believe the story, someone's told you in church and so forth and so on, without really looking closely at it, that's your business, obviously. But if you look really closely, first of all, you don't find any evidence externally, that any solid, credible scientific evidence external to the New Testament that even goes remotely into this story. There's some odd rumors from 100 years before that, and there's other Jesuses mentioned in Josephus, and then of course then there's the whole Testimonium Flavianum, which is patently a forgery. But of course that's widely disputed. But if you look closely at these, and at my book, Who is Jesus? Fingerprints of the Christ, really analyzes the four canonical gospels and shows where all the problems are and how they don't show up in the historical or archaeological record until the second century. So we don't even have any evidence that these were in existence anywhere near the time of when Christ supposedly existed. Even the language of them, of the Greek, is later than it's being portrayed. The disciples themselves were supposedly illiterate, but all of a sudden, miraculously, they become great speakers of Greek, which is also not supposed to be their native tongue, and writers, of course, when they're illiterate. So, yeah, you have a lot of strange conflicting ideas going on here and claims that are not backed up by even the titles of the books, the Gospel according to Matthew, these are late innovations. These earlier, the texts, they're not mentioned until the end of the second century. They're not named as such until the end of the second century. They don't show up in the historical record until the end of the second century. Not clearly anyway. They're intimations in other texts such as the works of Justin Martyr, but even those, not verbatim. What you discover is that these are texts, even Luke, the prologue of Luke says that he is drawing from, or before him are many who tried to write this story, many. So by his time, there were many Gospels circulating. And I mean, you're not taught these things in church. You don't know, you don't realize this. They just tell you that this is where how it happened. We have a strong historical lineage to determine this. And then you look back and you go, wait a second. That strong historical lineage was fabricated by Eusebius in the 4th century. I mean, there's no evidence of Peter really even existing, much left having, less having been the first bishop of the church. I mean, there's all this stuff is very wishy-washy and fishy when you start looking closely at it.
Well, it does sound really kind of fishy, so I'm going to ask you kind of the million-dollar question here. Do you believe that Jesus really existed, or do you think that he was just a fantasy character?
There are two main disciplines to look at for this subject, for that particular question. One is the idea of disproving that Jesus existed by looking at the material that we do have, just looking at it, but drilling down. And that would be like my book, Who is Jesus? And the other is looking at the mythical motifs that you find in other cultures, long predating some of them, long predating the Christian era, so that we have Jesus never existed and we have Jesus as a myth. And the Jesus never existed part of it is, like I say, when you're looking at people are trying to prove, you can't really prove a negative, so that is just a preliminary to me, that you're looking at the scientific evidence for some character in the New Testament. But if you start looking in the, and you will not find it. You will not find it. That will deal with Josephus, Pliny, Suetonius, Tacitus, Phlegon, Thallus, all these claims that supposedly are showing that there was some guy there who did something or other. And everybody, what the something or other he did is entirely dependent on the person looking at the story. This is the funny phenomenon about this particular story is everybody looks at Jesus and says, well, you know, he was a great healer. He was a revolutionary. And then you look at the person who's making these claims, and they're often themselves great healers or rebels or something like that. There's a lot of projection on that end. You take a break?
Acharya, we need to take a quick break. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're talking to Acharya about her book, The Christ Conspiracy. Her webpage is truthbeknown.com, and we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Are you sensitive to energy? Want to explore the world beyond the five senses? Looking for a new career as an alternative healthcare practitioner? Then the Institute of Applied Energetics, Medical Intuition, and Energy Medicine Training Programs may be right for you. Our comprehensive curriculum provides students with a deep understanding of how to detect, evaluate, and transform the subtle body, as well as techniques for correcting energetic imbalances that may underscore a person's ability to experience radiant health. So if you are sensitive to energy, contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Visit www.appliedenergeticsinstitute.com and start your new career today. How would you like to live long and enjoy great health? How about creating solid bones and whiter teeth? Strengthen your heart and eyes and have radiant, youthful-looking skin. There is an ancient health and longevity secret that has been used for millennia in Egypt, India, and China that can help you achieve this. For the first time in the modern world, Pearlseum brings this ancient wellness secret to you. For more information about Pearlseum, visit www.productsforthesoul.com. Before we get back to the show, I would like to thank all of you for tuning into Just Energy Radio. Many of the people I've helped over the years were listeners just like you. If you're at a junction in your life, don't stand alone at this important time. Call me or send me an email. We can set up a private consultation so that you too can experience health, healing, and wholeness in your life. To find out more about the services I offer, visit www.soulhealer.com.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise and we're here talking to Acharya about her book, The Christ Conspiracy. But before I bring her back on the line, don't forget to stay tuned to the show. We're going to have our Mind Yoga Question where you can win a copy of Haunted Spaces and Sacred Places later on in the show. You can also win a chance to get a free psychic reading from the students at the Institute of Applied Energetics. That's www.appliedenergeticsinstitute.com. Acharya, before we went to break, we were talking about the different books of the Bible, and I think I want to start, I have a couple of questions about that, with the sources. You were talking about some of the non-biblical sources like Josephus. From what I understand, based on those sources, that Jesus never really showed up in the contemporary writings. John the Baptist showed up, or what they think is a reference to John the Baptist showed up, so that would say that he was a prominent figure, or a fairly prominent figure, but nothing about the big JC. True?
Well, yeah, contemporarily, John the Baptist doesn't show up either, and I can explain his presence in Josephus. Yeah, none of these figures show up. Not even Paul shows up. So what's going on there? Yeah, Paul's making all kinds of extraordinary claims of troops being sent out, and yet he shows up nowhere. And the thing about Christ that would be perplexing if you did not have a mythicist perspective of the story would be that someone like Philo of Alexandria, who was also called Philo Judaeus because he was Jewish and ostensibly visited Judea, wrote a huge amount of material that we still have that basically describes the word, the logos, to a T, and takes Jewish theology and combines it, or Hellenizes it, combines it with Greek thought as well as Egyptian and Roman thought and other stuff that was current at the time in the Mediterranean. And so Philo lived right smack at the time when Christ was supposedly walking the earth in Judea, which is the story in the gospel is a 90-mile long part of the world. It's tiny. So anybody in that area where some guy was wandering around. We have some 20-plus scriptures in the New Testament claiming that Jesus was famed far and wide, had thousands of people following him. He fed all these, you know, miraculously feeding mobs of people. He's standing on mountaintops giving speeches. He's got the whole of the priesthood, the Jewish priesthood after him. He's all these dramatic stories are going on in this tiny little area, and yet nobody mentions him. Philo has not a word to say. The Logos that he is describing shows up in his own native country, that he lived in Alexandria. But he was, here's a little secret about Philo people don't realize. He was from the wealthiest family in the Mediterranean at the time. So he had the ability to move around. He was involved with the famous and wealthy, powerful people, including the emperors. And yet, he has nothing to say about some guy who supposedly landed on planet Earth and was like the walking logos he had described to a T. Not a word, nothing. Doesn't notice him. Didn't know he existed at all. So you look at stuff like that and you go, well, there's something wrong here. Something's wrong with this picture. This guy's famed far and wide. We have absolutely no acknowledgement of his existence in any contemporary record. And this was one of the better documented periods of the time. This was not part of the Dark Ages that followed, thank you to deliberate efforts at wiping out literacy. This was a well-documented period, and there were many people writing. And so I have lists of these people. Some of the list that I created of the people at the time who were at least well-known writers of some degree was prominently featured in the movie Zeitgeist, which you may have heard of. So that, if people are familiar with that list of writers of the time, that comes from my book, Who Was Jesus, as well. So that whole, the whole sources, I go into, in Who Was Jesus, I go into looking closely at these supposed sources, which come from a much later period. You were talking about Josephus's mentions of, actually it's Josephus.
I mean, he's probably one of the most, he's probably one of the most well-known, you know, off the top of your head names from that period. That's why I threw him out.
Right, because Christians kept that book going, otherwise it would be lost too, probably. But although supposedly some Jews had got their hands on it at a certain point, but that was centuries later. Now Josephus, that book is not published until about 100. You know, CE or AD. So that's not an eyewitness account. Now, his family is supposed to be living right in that area at the time. And yet, other than this Testimonium Flavianum, which I'm convinced is so obviously a forgery, other than that, he has no mention of Jesus. There's no interest in him. His parents would have been there at the exact time when all of this was going on, and you would think that they would have maybe mentioned something. Hey, there was this guy, you know, thousands of people following him. The whole priesthood was upset. He apparently came in and was rampaging through the temple and all this other stuff, and yet that doesn't seem to have crossed anyone's mind. So,
but couldn't Jesus have just, you know, had like a really good PR guy? You know, I think Paul, as an example, even though he wasn't, you know, there with Jesus, was a great PR guy. And if it wasn't for him, Christianity would have just done nothing. I mean,
well,
you know, even though you're saying that he might not even been a real person, but if he were a real person, he was like the best PR guy.
Well, not if the New Testament says he was famed far and wide. Over 20 times it says that, and yet there's no record anywhere else. I mean, they would.
Well, they're just liars.
You'd have to.
They got a really big fish.
Oh, yeah, that's a fish, all right. It's a fish story. So
I always joke around and go, you know, they had a little nosh. You know, there were the thousands of people, and they had a little nosh. That's how they spread it.
Right. Well, no, but my point is that it was not spread, that you do not find any, you find no archaeological records of this. You find a piece of an inscription about Pilate, supposedly. Well, that inscription is a very odd-looking thing. But that doesn't, still doesn't, that'd be like saying, well, we know that England exists, therefore Gulliver must have been a real person. If you're writing a historical fiction, of course you're going to place it in a time, and you're probably going to throw in a few historical characters. But no solid evidence from that era at all. And what we do have is very sketchy when you look at it closely. That whole debate is what I call the Jesus never existed debate, where you go into all this nitty gritty of the supposed evidence. But then if you start looking at the other side of it, which is Jesus is a myth, and that's based on previous myths, you look at the evidence, which has also not been widely disseminated. You don't get this in your church and so forth, talking about how, for example, Hercules is the son of a mortal woman and a god, just like Jesus. So he's the son of God, and he has these miraculous powers. And, the figure, the number 12, is very prominent in his story as well. And he supposedly walked the earth and did all kinds of savior routines and so forth. And you see these stories, and then there's Osiris.
Actually, why don't we come back to that? Because that's like a whole huge topic that I want to get into because I think it's fascinating.
That's where I like to go. That's my whole thing is to bring out because
that's your big
cultures.
Thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then let's just keep going down this path. But let me ask a question because I think it's interesting that. And actually, I found it fascinating because one of the things that you do in your book is take all of the different myths, and I'll give you a chance to talk about some of your favorite ones, and really coalesce them into, you know, a handy-dandy reference guide where, you know, you might know, like, this little piece or that little piece, but you got very specific. And I think the one that was my favorite piece was that because you list, like, different attributes that they have. And I think my favorite attribute that I saw in just about everyone that you talked about was they were all born on Christmas. It's a miracle. Anyway,
yeah.
So you were going on to any comment, and then you could go back to Osiris or wherever you were going because I thought that was just really fascinating.
Well, I have a follow-up book on that because that's a part of solar mythology. That has to do with the winter solstice. And so my next book is called Sons of God, Krishna, Buddha, and Christ Unveiled, because two of the solar myths that were contended to have winter solstice births are Krishna and Buddha as well, but according to, of course, the mainstream, that's entirely incorrect. So I followed up in the researching of that information, and, you know, of course, I discovered interesting parts of. First of all, people are misconstruing Krishna and Buddha as being real people too, who actually walked the earth and did all these wild supernatural things. And so if you read Sons of God, you also start discovering, well, these look like solar myths too. And, you know, there's this whole solar mythology with a priesthood that is actually continuing to this day because, indeed, Hinduism is largely solar-based. So, and Buddhism, you find out, but there's a lot of lunar information in Buddhism as well. But you start looking closely at their stories, and you discover a few things that are indicative of this winter solstice rising. For example, Krishna is the incarnation of the god Vishnu, who is clearly a solar myth, and he is depicted as rising at the winter solstice. So we do have a basis for claiming that the rise or the incarnation or the rebirth of Vishnu occurs at the winter solstice. And then within Buddhism, you have the appearance of the Buddha of Light, and in fact, you can find this kind of really nitty gritty, interesting information in my astrotheology calendar, where I delved into the month of December with the winter solstice festivals. It's just absolutely fascinating. So you can also get that astrotheology calendar. Shows all of these different winter solstice celebrations around the world dating back thousands of years. And you really get a perspective of how potent was this mythology and how it's been lost to us. I mean, growing up, I didn't even know what the winter solstice was. I mean, it was Christmas time. It was the birth of Jesus. What did it have to do with the sun? And nobody taught us that it's basically the winter solstice. You know, so this has been, I mean, it's amazing how they could really wipe out this knowledge that had been so vital to humanity for so many thousands of years. And these other characters, there's a lot about, when I go into the solar mythology and Sons of God, I discuss numerous of these characters like Mithra and Osiris and Asclepius and other gods of the ancient world and their solar attributes. And indeed, you know, I was talking about Osiris having this perpetual death and resurrection going on, just like Christ every year. Every year at Easter, in Greece, for example, they yell "Christos Anesti," which means Christ is risen. So every year, Christ dies and is resurrected. And this is the same thing that we find in the Egyptian mythology, which I bring out in a very large, dense, scholarly book called Christ in Egypt. That in the Egyptian mythology, you have the baby son Horus being born every morning. And of course, he's also born on December 25th. And in fact, even 2,000 years ago or so, Plutarch is talking about how the baby Horus is born at the winter solstice because he's largely a solar god. And so this is where the death and resurrection come in. And if you follow the sun, the yearly annual movements of the sun, you start finding out, well, of course, now we have an Easter celebration where the sun is at the vernal equinox and it's essentially on a cross and it is it's still overcoming the death of the winter time. And then there's this great victory when the night begins to be, or the day begins to be longer than the night. And so it is said that, you know, the sun has risen. The worship on the sun day is another indication of an ancient pre-Christian solar festival, and so on and so forth. So all of these gods, these attributes, when you see that they're resolving into solar myths, then you start understanding why they have so many of these things in common. And even the whole healing aspect, which is another thing that they regularly share. These gods are always healers, which will remind me of another story that leads into how this whole Christian effort came to be. This healer is the sun, again, because, of course, to the ancients, they would obviously see that when the sun shines on the earth, it brings up life. So, you know, there's that healing essence there. But also, lying in the sun, if you have skin issues, has always been very helpful, unless you have some kind of genetic problem with, you know, with the sun. There are people like that. But otherwise, it's good for the bones, it's good for your eyes, it's good for your brain, it's good for your skin. We need the sun. And so we do find in ancient texts that the sun is called the healer and the savior. And that was what all of these gods represented. The solar attributes were so important that even if a god started out not as a sun god or a goddess, that these attributes were eventually attached to the god. If the priesthood wanted that god to be the most important one, he had to have solar attributes, especially in the later centuries, later the millennia.
So I'm going to ask an even bigger question. So why would we sit here and worship the sun? I mean, what would even take us down that path in the first place? And I'm just going to put what I think. I think that some of the ancient gods that were out there, Krishna, you know, I don't really, you know, I think there's the name and then there is the person, but I think that some of the really ancient gods and traditions actually were real people, like Osiris or some other name for that character was a real person and they were deified. You know, but the whole memory of their existence was lost, and they could have just been, you know, some ruler person that got grandiose. He got a big fish, too. I mean, I think that's another possibility out there as well.
Well, that's called the Evemeris theory, and my book is designed to show that that's not correct. That the Christ conspiracy, I bring up these theories at the beginning. One, of course, is the believer theory, then is the Evemeris theory, and then there's the mythicist theory. And I'm showing that neither the believer nor the Evemeris theories have as much merit as the mythicist. So the Evemeris theory...
And why is that?
Well, we only have evidence for this in a couple of instances, really serious evidence for it. For example, with Alexander the Great, you know, he was deified. Or Roman Caesars are considered to be gods on earth. There seems to have been one god in Egyptian, all the gods in the Egyptian mythology, there only seems to be one who could be considered to be truly Evemeris, and that was Imhotep, who was an ancient physician. And apparently was divinized or deified or turned into a god, but no, Osiris absolutely not. This is, you're talking about an ancient, not just a solar but a lunar god as well, and also the god of the Nile and of water. And there's no way this was just a person who was turned into a human being any more than Hercules. I mean, there's supposed to be 44 different Hercules running around in Greece, and there's no way you can point to one of them and say, well, yeah, this was a real guy who took down the Hydra, you know, or Perseus going after Medusa. It's just these are not real people. These are stories that were essentially from the beginning, because you can trace elements of their tales to where they came from as being observations of natural phenomena. And the same thing with Christ. When you start peeling off the mythological layers or the layers of sayings from people who did exist, yes, of course, people have said things, but you find his sayings, the sayings of the Lord or the sayings of Jesus, you find them in older texts like the Old Testament, for example, or the apocryphal or the intertestamental literature of in between the New and the Old Testament that was written by Jews. You can find sayings in there too. For example, Ecclesiasticus is in the Catholic Bible. It's called the Wisdom of Jesus, this text. These were two Jesuses involved in writing this book, and it dates from centuries before Christ supposedly existed. So there are sayings of Jesus right there that you can see, some of which had been changed into what ends up in the New Testament. So what I say in cases, you have to go case by case with whether or not Evemerism has any merit. You have to look, okay, we can pretty much say that Alexander was a real person, even though he was deified. So that's a case. We can look at Imhotep, and I think Imhotep may be a solid case of Evemerism. But when you start peeling away all these mythical layers or these sayings and so forth, which some of the sayings in the New Testament also could be traced to the Egyptian eschatology, the Egyptian texts, the Book of the Dead and pyramid texts and so forth, we start peeling all this stuff away, you really are left with no core to the onion. My work is designed to show that there really is no core to this onion. It's not that I specifically started off with that, but this Evemerism perspective is raised often by people who were many times born into Christianity, but they just don't believe the supernatural aspects of it, and they still think, well, there's some guy there. Well, yes, there is some guy. There are several guys there. But in the end, a composite of 20 people is no one. And so we're still dealing with a mythical figure, or a fictional character, even if there is some guy there. For example, with Paul, there's some guy there. Somebody wrote those Pauline epistles. But the rest of the stories that are attached to him, many of them are not provably real events. And they look like they were plucked out of Josephus' life. They look like they were plucked out of the legends about Orpheus and possibly Pythagoras and Apollonius of Tyana. And so combining all of these characters together still does not make a historical figure, one historical figure. So that's the problem with Evemerism. Is even if you could find which guy are you pointing to that was Osiris? I mean, who is he? What is he doing? There's no you know, the stories, the pure stories about Osiris take place in the ethers. They take place in the what's called the Pleroma in the Gnostic perspective, but not on planet Earth, not wandering around the Earth, actually doing the things that were said of him. So you find these myths. Go ahead.
And so taking that point around Jesus, why would they? I mean, you know, there's ancient man, but why would they, you know, at 1 BC or 1 AD or, you know, whatever, 200 AD or whatever, decide to create this whole new mythic legend at that time? You know, if there wasn't, you know, somebody, yeah, funky as he was in his own day, you know, why would they spend the time creating this persona?
Well, this is where you have to really study the milieu of the era. You know, at the time, you have to look at the Mediterranean, what is happening in the Mediterranean at the day. And you also have to have some knowledge of pre-Christian cultures and their mythology and the fact is that many people today are quite convinced that, you know, the stories of ancient Greece are myths. We're taught that those are myths. These are not real people. Zeus isn't a real person. He wasn't really up on Mount Olympus. I've been to Mount Olympus. It's a fascinating, amazing place, but I can pretty much guess that there's no guy sitting up on top of it who's immortal. And yet, you know, to the Greeks, if you said that Hercules wasn't a real person and he didn't walk on planet Earth, you could be killed. This was a capital offense against the gods. So they very much took their gods as having been real people who walked the earth, or at least something. I mean, Zeus was always coming down to earth and walking among the people and getting in trouble with women and so forth. And so, like I said, that would be blasphemy. But today we look back and we say, of course they're myths. I mean, we know exactly what the meaning is. So somebody made up the myths, right? I mean, somebody went to Crete, where I've been several times. They had a birth and a death cave for Zeus on Crete. So they're quite convinced. They were quite convinced that Zeus was born into the world and that he died out of the world. They have the caves to prove it. They're probably 2,500 years, or not older, actually. I think they're maybe closer to 3,000 years old, these birth and death caves. I've actually been in them. And so do they prove that Zeus walked the earth? No, of course not. Somebody named them these caves. Somebody decided that. It was a priest, probably, or some local person got all excited and started telling stories. But in any event, eventually the priesthood gets involved in all of this. And so we're agreed that there are myths. We're agreed that there are mythical figures. We're agreed that somebody had to make them up. Somebody made them up. Well, who? Well, often priests and priesthoods. And so, you know, it's not surprising that a new god is made up. I mean, right before Christ supposedly existed, they took a god from the Persians into Rome called Mithra and made up a big story about him. And, you know, he was born in a cave and had people coming, shepherds and so forth. And so somebody's making these stories up. We agree about that. And there's reason for that.
We need to take another quick break. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're talking to Acharya about her book, The Christ Conspiracy. We will be back after these words from our sponsors.
Crossroads in your life and discover alternative solutions to your deepest concerns at soulhealer.com. So whether it's a physical problem, an emotional issue, a question about work, or troubles in your relationships, naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise can help you. Bring peace, harmony, and health back into your life. Schedule a session today. Visit soulhealer.com right away and live the life you've been dreaming of.
Start the year off right by visiting livinggrocery.com. Experience the miracle of real nutrition as it helps you to lose weight and improve your overall health. Don't mess with pills or capsules. We provide the highest quality all-natural organic foods that come ready to eat, and best of all, it's delivered straight to your door. Visit livinggrocery.com now and experience your own amazing transformation.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and thank you for staying tuned to the second hour of the show. If you're enjoying the programming today, please do mark this show as a favorite. And don't forget, stay tuned. We're going to have our mind yoga question of the day where you can stretch your mind, get some of them cobwebs out. But we're going to get back to talking about the big JC, where we're talking about Acharya's book, The Christ Conspiracy. Welcome back.
No.
We're still going strong.
Yeah.
Question. One of the things you talked about that I thought was very interesting was that even as early as, and I'm going to say the second century AD, there was already debate about whether Jesus was a person.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Gnosticism. It's called Docetism. Docetus or Docetus. However, but this is a group of Gnostics who claimed that they may have claimed that while the story happened, it was in a fantastic environment. It wasn't really on the earth. Jesus didn't really take a body. This is all going on in the world of myth. In fact, is basically what they're saying. And in fact, if you start looking at all of the coalescing of these ideas coming together to produce this effort, you find out that before it was turned into a historical event that happened to a supposedly Jewish guy or Jewish people, that it was a Gnostic thing going on, that there was no historicizing, no Judaizing. It was, in fact, the Gnostic effort was quite universal. They used Syrian ideas and language. They used Indian ideas and language. They used Hebrew, Greek, some Latin. It was quite universal. And then you can tell, I think, that they were trying to create a religion that was more universal and less third dimensional, because the people constantly fighting over whose God is bigger and better than everyone else's. And so this is the why of it all. We had, as I was saying before the break, that we have priests who are clearly making up gods over a period of thousands of years, many thousands of years, as it turns out, going back to Stone Age and then been 20,000 years. We find some artifacts that are religiously based, like the Venus of LaSalle and goddess worshiping figures and so forth. And so we have this whole long history of religious ideation, and then we have clear cut priesthoods developing, and they are building buildings such as temples and Stonehenge, for example, sacred sites that have both a spiritual function and also a astronomical observation function. In a nutshell is astrotheology. So you look back at these times and you see this development going on of religious ideology or ideas, and then you start and you see, well, there's a priesthood and it's got this well-refined technology of creating myths and religions. And, of course, then you have this culmination in Egypt, which is just astounding. And I didn't even know how astounding it was until I wrote Christ in Egypt, or digging into all of the ancient texts, thousands of them, and saying, wow, they really had it down. I mean, their whole culture was... It's like Islam today. It's all revolving around religion. Everything revolved around it. The smallest task had some kind of religious meaning. and they built their entire culture over this, their religion, and it is largely solar. There's a lot of lunar aspects to it as well, and other celestial events. And then, of course, we have in Egyptian mythology, we have dog-headed or baboon-headed gods, and then there's Anubis with the jackal head, and then, you know, the crocodile Sobek, and so forth. And so their whole perspective was divine, you know, all of creation. And so, but yet you know that they're making these myths up, obviously. Is there really a crocodile-headed god named Sobek? And so forth. So we know we have people making up myths. We have priests making up religions. And right before Christianity, there was not only the Mithraism coming into blossom, but there had already been in Alexandria a concerted effort to combine two pagan cultures, the Egyptian and the Greek, with Judaism. Judaism is kind of is often left out of the picture in this regard, but in fact the evidence shows that this particular cult was created for the Jews as well, and I'm talking about the cult of Serapis, this brand new god that was made up 2 to 3 centuries before the Common Era, before Christ supposedly lived. Here we have a clear cut. There was no man there. There was no Evemerism. There's absolutely no one would ever say that, because what the priests did was take Osiris and his Apis bull and combine them for the specific reason of appealing to Greeks and Egyptians together in order to unite those two factions in Egypt. There were a lot of Greeks and Jews in Alexandria during that era, and they were, all these factions, the Greeks, the Egyptians, and the Jews were always fighting, the Jews amongst themselves as well, with the Samaritans fighting with the Judeans going on there. And so, obviously, the powers that be, the wealthy, powerful people who were both politicians and priests, were saying, look, we got to do something. These people are constantly fighting. There's rioting. It's religious. It was religious, religiously based fighting. So we need to create a new god to combine them, to bring them together, to have them. The Greeks shared with the Jews a compulsion to do animal sacrifice. And so this was not really all that palatable to the Egyptians of the time. And so they thought, well, let's make up this god who combines Osiris and the Apis bull. The Jews in the Old Testament, you know, the bull is very important to them to be sacrificing, and they constantly slaughtering bulls and throwing the blood of the bulls upon the people, and explaining the New Testament line, let his blood be upon us and our children. So this is another thing, too, that my work in this absolves Jews of the Christ killer epithet, and I think that really is an important point. Seriously, I mean, at last we can say Jews are not responsible for murdering God. Can we get over it now? End of story. That was one of the things I realized. I thought, my God, they've been slandered hideously all these centuries for this, you know, the story being misunderstood by the rabble. But so we had this effort with Serapis, and it was quite concerted and quite popular with the elite. They put a lot of money and effort into creating this god in order to appeal to the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Jews, to bring them together and unite them under one religion in Alexandria, at least, or in other parts of Egypt. And they built this Serapion that had a significant portion of the Library of Alexandria in it, and it was very important. In fact, by the time that we're talking about, the first century, the cult of Serapis was extremely important to the elite in the Roman Empire, and the moneyed people. In fact, so much so that Vespasian, who subsequently became emperor, he destroyed the temple. He and his son Titus destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. They not only are they destroying the temple, but and that's kind of a symbol right there. You know, we're trying to get rid of Judaism to replace it with this merged cult here, which was Serapis at the time, and he goes into the temple of Serapis. And many of the very wealthy, important people of the era were worshiping in the Temple of Serapis. Of course, there were many other gods and goddesses. Isis was arguably the most popular at the time all around the Mediterranean, up into Great Britain. And Mithra, also hugely popular, and popular with powerful people as well. All of them were, essentially. Then you have all these mystery schools and brotherhoods, and they're all involved in this, too. And so, in fact, there's something that I really fleshed this out. I talk about Alexandria in Christ Conspiracy and in Sons of God, and I get to it in Christ in Egypt as well, right? It's so germane to look at Alexandria as the crucible of Christianity. And if you look at this whole area, you start seeing it was far more developed and far more cosmopolitan than people understand. They think that, well, this just happened in this little backwater, tiny, small place, and there's nothing else going on. You know, there's just cavemen dragging people by the hair, and don't realize that we had massive buildings and cities going on. We had at least 500,000, I believe, in Alexandria at the time, 500,000 people. And that's a major port with traffic going back and forth and commerce. And there are guilds and brotherhoods and, you know, unions for centuries already in this Mediterranean area. It's quite well built up. It's not just some... I mean, you go there now and you look at it, and it's not that much different than it was. There's still the ancient buildings standing in some of these places. A lot of warfare has destroyed that in time, of course. But, you know, it wasn't just some unsophisticated, technologically retarded place. It was actually quite well-developed, and there was a lot of commerce and a lot of cultural exchange going on. And so you have this effort in this area with wealthy people spreading around through brotherhoods, and they're writing texts, and they're all the places where Paul supposedly went and started churches. Well, guess what? The churches were already there, and they weren't Christian churches. They were pre-Christian sacred sites. And they're actually – the word ecclesia for churches, I trace this also in Christ in Egypt. It was a popular term already.
I mean, we had a question in the chat, and you kind of, like, came back to this point, so I'm just going to, like, jump in here with the question.
Okay.
You know, and I asked this question, and it has been asked a couple of times in the chat room. Did Paul really exist? And I'm going to add my little twist onto it. You know, if he wasn't a literal character, then who would go and spread Christianity around? I just am feeling like there's a piece missing. It's like, and actually there was another question, which I thought was a great question that kind of fit into it. You know, if religion isn't based on history, then what's the function? And so what would be the purpose of creating, and let's kind of, you know, talk about Christianity so it's not so enormous. You know, what would be the point?
Well, let me finish up this point with Serapis, because this goes back to it answers so many of these questions anyway. Now, you have this concerted effort to create this savior healing god named Serapis to unite these different factions. And it was kind of like their first attempt at this, and it didn't quite work. But by the second century, it was testified that people supposedly calling themselves Christians were really worshippers of Serapis, as were Jews. And that was supposedly in a letter from Hadrian, in fact, the Emperor Hadrian. Now, this guy, Serapis, is depicted with the long, curly black hair, wearing a white robe. And exactly. In fact, the image, it was claimed, the image of Serapis in his temple in Alexandria was just wholesale lifted to turn into Jesus. And so... What I'm trying to say here is we already had all these efforts going on, and we had this brotherhood network. It's quite extensive, and the churches that Paul supposedly went to already existed. And so he didn't go around founding churches, and he didn't go around proselytizing a Jewish guy that had just lived there. In fact, if you go, there's one of my friends has possibly the best book on the subject of the Pauline epistles serving as no real evidence for historical Jesus. That's called The Jesus Puzzle by Earl Doherty. Now, he has shown that the idea that whoever Paul was, you can say there was a person writing these letters, but that he was talking about something that was not a historical character. He's talking about this spiritual entity that you can find within Gnosticism as well, but also who is large. You know, it's the same spiritual entity behind the solar mythology. And so if someone is going around these brotherhood places that already exist and talking about this, they just gave it a new title, which isn't even that new, Christos. Talking about this spiritual entity that, you know, Christos makes us one. For you, neither Jew nor Greek, neither male nor female, you're all one in Christ Jesus. Then that is not necessarily saying that there was some guy who was walking around on the earth who is this Christ Jesus that we're all one in. Christos means anointed. Jesus just means salvation or healer if it's traced to a Greek root. So he could be talking about the same thing, in fact, that tradition has of the Greek figure named Orpheus, who also went to pretty much the same places and preached the kingdom of Dionysus, who's the savior god who died and resurrected. And this was going on for centuries. There was a whole proselytizing group of they were actors and they had this religious play going on where they would teach about Dionysus, the great savior, who had many other things in common with Christ as well, and who was like one of the main figureheads of the mysteries. So now we get into the mysteries, which are very complicated, but let me just say that these people who were going around these different brotherhood sites were preaching the mysteries, and they were not necessarily talking about Dionysus as having been a real person. But then you find this pattern of going around these brotherhood places. As far as this, now it comes back to Paul again. Paul seems to be a composite character of the person who seems to be going around at that time to the brotherhood places, that, you know, Corinth and Ephesus and the other sites in that he's addressing, the Galatians and in all those New Testament letters, the epistles. Person who seems to be at the basis of the original writings. Those writings have all been appended, you know, and worked over by many hands following, but the core of those letters seems to be Apollonius of Tyana, because he's also a member of the Brotherhood, and the story had him going to the exact same places that Paul goes to, albeit in reverse. And I actually bring out this material in a relatively short article, but so that particular journey where we have somebody going around, we have Apollonius doing this at almost the same time. We also had Orpheus supposedly going around to these different brotherhoods. We had Pythagoras going around to all these different brotherhoods. You know, they all go and start talking whatever they've picked up. Pythagoras supposedly was in India and brought back, Apollonius too, brought back Indian doctrines and possibly a Krishna or Buddhist, you know, a Hindu or Buddhist text or two to base the parts of the New Testament on. You could trace certain Indian ideas, particularly in the Gospel of Matthew, with, for example, the slaughter of the infants, the massacre of the innocents by Herod. So what you see is that there's already this organized brotherhood, and there are all these ideas are already around, going around in them, and they're, you know, starting to formulate them and bring them together. They try with Serapis, that doesn't quite work. Mithraism is a big effort, but Mithraism ignores women, so that doesn't quite work. So, you know, then when you look at all this background, you start saying, oh, that's why they threw that story in, and that's why they put this in there, and that's why, because they're really trying to roll everything into one and combine it with Judaism. Already tried with Serapis, didn't quite work because Jews would stick to the Old Testament. And you couldn't just, you had to append that to whatever effort you were going to make if you were going to really try to include Judaism and combine Judaism with paganism. Had to append the Old Testament there. That's the only explanation for taking, I mean, the Romans were not going to just take the Old Testament and say, oh, okay, these are the chosen people, let's, you know, fall down at their feet and hand over the keys to our kingdom to them. It had to have been really a tremendous effort to accept that whole branch of society. In fact, it was very troublesome to them. You can read that in, especially in Christ's Conspiracy, about how, the stubbornness of Jews as concerns that while they were often willing to accept other people's cultures and, like, became, for example, they became quite Hellenized with Greek culture. Most of the Jews at the time were speaking Greek, not Hebrew. At the same time, there was, you know, a certain segment who were so stubbornly attached to their scriptures because they believed that they were divinely inspired, that they wouldn't give them up. So they had to make this new effort to bring that fold into the story, and of course it ends up being the dominant, one of the dominant characteristics of the effort. But anyway, so those are the whys. I mean, and the whys are trying to unite the, and probably the powermongers thought to themselves at the time, hey, you know, the idea of monotheism might be a good idea because then we have a central priesthood that we can control everything from. Whereas, of course,
so are we kind of talking about, like, you know, Big Brother and the powers that be, except, you know, zero BC style or AD or style?
Absolutely.
You know, instead
Absolutely.
Of wearing, you know, black suits, they wore, like, you know, brown togas. They're the ones in the brown toga with the beard.
the brown shirts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they did.
But are you kind of talking about the same thing, except not, I guess?
Well, yes. It's the same. It's a similar effort to making a new god to appeal to someone, which has been a constant effort. I mean, it goes on. We have gods of every culture that are designed to appeal to the people whose culture they're in. For example, the sun god in Japan is actually a goddess, and she's Japanese-looking, Amaterasu. She looks like a Japanese. So they took in the sun, and they've turned it into a Japanese woman. And that's what I'm saying happened everywhere, of course. You know, if you're in Peru, and that's a well-known sun-worshipping culture, they depict the sun god as a Peruvian man. I mean, so they're trying to bring home all the different cultures, roll them into one, depict them. Of course, now they ended up turning him into a Jewish guy, which you can see that there was fighting against that in the second century with the Gnostics and Marcion and all these other characters who were very, very adamantly against the Old Testament Yahweh, Demiurge, they called him. So, but like I said, talk about monotheism. If you looked at the Old Testament and the stories in there, you have this, well, eventually the Old Testament priests are in control of almost everything that the followers are doing. So monotheism becomes total tyranny and fascism, obviously. You know, you have this one God, and you are the power beneath the one God controlling the masses. You're the chosen people. We are to be the priests to the whole world. We talk for God. We know what God wants. It's the ultimate power play. And so, of course, possibly at one point someone said, look, you know, we got to get rid of all these other gods because we don't have a centralized priesthood. In the Old Testament, we see the priests of the Levites, the Jewish priests going around and destroying everybody else's gods, you know, the high places where the Canaanites were worshiping. They have to go after them and destroy them. And eventually what people don't realize is that these high places where these sacrifices were going on to the gods were actually also utilitarian, because they were bringing their food animals up there, and before they would kill the food animals, they would sacrifice to them. You know, they're actually doing a kind of a good gesture there with the animals, saying we are, you know, this is a sacrifice to the gods and so forth, but they would eat the food afterwards. Now what happened is the Jewish priesthood decides that they want everybody to sacrifice at Jerusalem so that they can get paid. And so they went and destroyed all the high places and forced people to bring their food animals all the way to Jerusalem to eat. So now they're controlling your very food. You can't eat without them blessing it, without them getting a bite of it, you know. And so this is, I think, someone say, hey, that's a good idea. And we know what happened after that. We have the Catholic Church. And what did they do? They terrorized the crap out of millions of people all over the world. What they did to the native Europeans is a massive Holocaust that is not being addressed. Slaughtered millions, tortured, stole all their wealth, destroyed their literacy, destroyed their culture, destroyed their buildings. Just ruination, utter ruination, and replacement with this new thing. And that, and of course, then they had fabulous, massive wealth from that. Just, you know, I mean, at one point the Catholic Church was undoubtedly the most powerful institution on the planet. It owned everything, especially in Europe.
Still does, just about.
It still owns a lot. There's supposed to be miles of booty underneath the Vatican, taken from all over the world, treasure. Wouldn't you like to get in there?
But, you know, even if you had an entire day to be in there, it would be like going to the Smithsonian, except on overdrive, because they got stuff that I'm sure is so old. But you'd have to go in with a camera or video, you know, and just run around, click, 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 click. I'm not really going to touch anything. Click, 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 click. And, yeah.
Yeah, I know, I know. You know, it sounds like to have a whole... It would be so cool to have a whole team of experts, like documents and language, linguists and so forth, and experts on every kind of archaeological or culture, ancient culture. That would be fantastic to go into, have free reign of the Vatican archives and these supposed tunnels underneath. And I mean, we know there's tunnels underneath. They're all over the place. They have to...
And it's like the Library of Alexandria.
Catacombs. Yeah. Oh, that would be
nice. I mean, that would be another place because that has the stuff that's even older. Unless, of course, somebody knew that it was going to burn down and they took all the good stuff out and took it to the Vatican, which you never know.
Well,
it could be in the
check
catacombs.
This out. Now,
ooh,
in,
you got
I
commentary.
Dropped... Yeah.
I'm going to shut up. Okay.
Well, no, that's that brings up something. There was a... oh gosh, an emperor at the end of the second century, and I wrote about him in Christ in Egypt. There's just a little nugget in there that is just fascinating. He went around and collected all the books that were exposing the mysteries, and he supposedly buried them in Alexander the Great's tomb. So, you know, if that were to be found, all of these books on the mysteries at the end of the second century just so happens to be when Christianity was being really formulated. That's when the Catholic Church came into being. That's when the New Testament shows up in its, you know, more or less the way it is now. That's when the Irenaeus first names the four evangelists. And all at the end of, around the second end of the second century, and then we have this emperor going around collecting texts. That, you know, exposing the mysteries and placing them. Yeah, I would love to have my hands on those. So I do think that some of this good stuff was preserved. And then, of course, what happened in Egypt is quite amusing because, oh, there we go again.
We'll have to come back.
What happened in Egypt?
I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're talking to Acharya about her book, The Christ Conspiracy. I moved it off my desk, but I marked a page because I have a quote I want to read when we come back from break. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We'll be back with the mind yoga question of the day after these words from our sponsor.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
In your life and discover alternative solutions to your deepest concerns at SoHealer.com. So whether it's a physical problem, an emotional issue, a question about work, or troubles in your relationships, naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise can help you. Bring peace, harmony, and health back into your life. Schedule a session today. Visit SoHealer.com right away and live the life you've been dreaming of.
Hi, I'm James Athayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Listen to Dr. Rita's Soul Healer Moment live each third Sunday night of the month on Feet to the Fire. www.feettofire.com for more information.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rita Louise, the host of Just Energy Radio and the founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics. Start a new career today on the leading edge of alternative health and healing. The Institute of Applied Energetics can help you develop the specialized skills you need to work as an energy medicine. practitioner, intuitive counselor, or professional medical intuitive. Besides our outstanding technical instruction, our programs also support you in creating and building a successful business in this rapidly growing field. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away or visit AppliedEnergeticsInstitute.com.
How would you like to live long and enjoy great health? How about creating solid bones and whiter teeth? Strengthen your heart and eyes and have radiant, youthful-looking skin. There is an ancient health and longevity secret that has been used for millennia in Egypt, India, and China that can help you achieve this. For the first time in the modern world, Pearlseum brings this ancient wellness secret to you. For more information about Pearlseum, visit www.productsforthesoul.com.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, where it's time for our Mind Yoga Question of the Week. And I forgot, I'd never answered last week's question, which nobody got right. And it's like, so guys, it's time to stretch those muscles in your brain. But this was last week's question. We were talking about crop circles, and the question was, when was the earliest crop circle recorded? And the answer was, in 1647, there was a woodcut called the Mowing Devil, which showed a devil actually making a crop circle in a field. So the answer was 1647. So this week, we have a new question. And again, if you would like to answer the question, send an email to justenergyradio@yahoo.com. That's justenergyradio@yahoo.com. The winner will get a copy of Sacred Spaces, Sacred Places by Brian Houghton and a chance to win a psychic reading brought to you by the Institute of Applied Energetics. That's AppliedEnergeticsInstitute.com. Here's this week's question. This group, which met in 1325, created a statement of belief which was used to define the core beliefs of Christianity. And so if you know what the answer is, send an email again to justenergyradio@yahoo.com. That's justenergyradio@yahoo.com. So let's get Acharya back on. There was a quote in your book. Oh, and actually, after I read this quote, I am going to open the phone lines. I'm a little hesitant, but we're going to open the phone lines. The number is 646-200-0698. That's 646-200-0698. So if you have a question, please do call in. When you call in that number, 646-200-0698, please hit the number, I think it's the number one button, saying that you'd like to speak to the host, and that would be me. Okay, there was a quote in your book which I thought was really excellent. I'm trying to figure out where I want to start. Biblical literists claim that everything in the Bible occurred literally and factually upon the earth, including taking talking snake, Noah's Ark, the parting of the Red Sea, the rising of the dead, and numerous other incredible miracles that apparently occurred only to biblical people at the time in that part of the world. The miraculous and implausible exploits of other cultures, however, are to be tossed aside as being unhistorical, mythological, and downright ridiculous. And I just, that was, I think, my favorite quote line in the book, because it's so true.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. You know, as I was a kid, I was inoculated by the Greek myths because you're trying to tell me these stories are myths, and then you're going to try to sell me this other culture's stories that are patently as ridiculous and supernatural, you know? And it occurred to me that this is not a truth based on scientific examination or scholarly endeavors or anything. It's really just a kind of a cultural bias. It's whose propaganda has been hitting us on the head the hardest. That's basically, you know, my God is bigger and better than yours. It depends on how much money you have and Believe me, people were assassinated who stood in the way of the spread of this. Entire cultures were wiped out. I mean, this was not something that was spread because people just like happily embraced it. You know, it was really quite compelled upon them. And knowing all of this, people say, well, you sound pissed when you wrote that book. So I was a little angry. I thought, well, gosh, my ancestors were slaughtered and tortured into this cult as well. You know, it is quite irritating. I wanted to say one thing before we go to the lines just the Egyptian thing that I had raised. I wanted to bring this up because centuries of destruction were not enough, by both Christians and then Muslims, were not enough to cover up all of the evidence. And so the opening of the hieroglyphs up to us through the Rosetta Stone translation and all that since the late 18th century, early 19th century, we have found so much evidence of what I'm talking about. It's just massively overwhelming, and it's too bad that our academia is so, again, with this cultural bias stuff and who's paying their bills, that they're not looking at this material because it's absolutely fascinating. So I just wanted to say that's Christ in Egypt really brings out a lot of this stuff that was not destroyed. So anyway, there we are now.
Okay, so it's like my little switchboard thing is being a little funky, so hopefully we're not going to blow ourselves up, technologically speaking. Get that lightning bolt. Hi, caller from the 216 area code. You're on the line. Do you have a question for us today? I know you've been very patient. You were like the first person that's tuned in.
It's John Smetana in Cleveland, Ohio. Can you hear me?
We can
hear
you. Can you hear?
Oh, great. All right. I was expecting a click. Let's see. Great. I discovered Acharya back in back around 2005 or 2004, something like that. Also back at that time, I noticed on the internet that there was a court case going on in Italy. Mm-hmm. And I guess there was an Italian over there by the name, I think his name was Luigi Cascioli.
And he had
the nerve of suing the Vatican, I think. I think it was the Vatican.
Sure did.
Making the claim that as you know, stated in Acharya's books, that Christ really didn't exist. And I can't find on the internet the results of that lawsuit. And I believe he lost because, again, the little bit that I did read on the internet was. The comments were pretty funny. What chance did he have going up against, you know, the Italian government and the Vatican in Italy? But I was wondering what the results of that was.
Yeah, you know, Luigi used to write to me years ago before he filed the lawsuit and in Italian. And so we had this communication going on, and he actually had some of my writings. Somebody had tried to translate them or something. So I was there cheering him on during that whole process, but he didn't get very far. He was going to try to bring in expert witnesses and so forth, but they wouldn't even entertain the notion of trying the case, the mythicist case in court, which would have been sweet. But, of course, instead they turned around and tried to make him look like he was diabolically. He actually sued a friend of his, somebody he went to school with. That's who he named in the lawsuit. It was a priest, a local priest. And that was just for, you know, legal purposes. It wasn't like he had anything against this guy. But they did turn around and try to make him pay for the court fees, and completely unwilling to even look into it. But that was fun, and I think there should be more like that, class action lawsuits. His case was based on fraud. He was trying to say these people are portraying a fictitious person as a real person and thereby defrauding people. And I think that case could be made again. If we had funds, we could do all kinds of things, but I operate on a shoestring budget.
That's a great question.
Thanks for bringing that up, John. It's nice to hear from you.
Okay, now we have a caller from the 313 area code. Caller from the 313 area code, are you there?
Hi, this is
Debbie.
Hi, did
you have a question? Hi, Debbie. Well, thanks for calling.
Hi. I was just looking through the channels today, and as soon as I clicked on your program, I heard her say, Sun God. And I said, wait a minute, I just had a dream about the Sun God a week ago. And I'm like, okay, what's up with the Sun God? Because I really don't know a lot. And I'm like, this you know, the universe trying to tell me something.
The Sun God is trying to contact you. Go outside and lie in the sun. It's the healer.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
I was just like, what?
That's funny. Well, you know, one of the things that motivates me is to the expressiveness. I don't hate religion. I don't hate it.
Mm-hmm.
I love all this stuff. That the expressions of the ancients towards their natural surroundings and beyond, because they conceived of the sun as a representation of the great one behind everything, you know, the great, you could call it God if you want to. But
yeah,
so they saw the sun as kind of crystallizing. Because, of course, when they observed the sun from several places, many places, the sun was bringing life to the planet, you know.
Right.
So it was extremely important. So all that solar mythology is very enlightening. Light, warmth, heat, healing, salvation every day. I mean, you can imagine in the ancient world you're out in the woods somewhere and you have all kinds of scary things in the dark and it's cold and you're freezing and you're shivering. If you've ever gone camping and you're freezing, you cannot wait for the sun to come up. And so that's
right.
The kind of sensation that brought about sun worship and solar mythology.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess it's time to talk to me.
Well, you know, there are no synchronicities, you know, or no accidents in this world. And so you probably needed to listen to the show today. And thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem.
Okay.
Thank
you. All right, you have a great day.
These astrotheological origins, the astrotheological origins of religion, are actually quite unifying. They go beyond culture, beyond language, beyond form. We don't have, you know, a white guy's face on the god. We don't have anybody else's culture. There's no monopoly. We can experience this sense of divinity and awe and reverence wherever we are. We don't have to be in a church. You don't have to have a priest between you and the divine or whatever you want to sense. If you want to feel that, go up to a mountain and feel that kind of thing. That's why I always use that as a case because I've done that. You just go up to a mountain and just stand there. You're in awe of creation. This is what I'm talking about, and this is what the ancients felt that led them to create these. I mean, I can't guess. I'm only guessing what the ancients felt, obviously. I'm speculation, but it's probably the same thing I feel. So in that case. So anyway.
Well,
it's a very
and if you thought. Really sit there and explore actually mystical, like Kabbalah, they don't talk about like God as a person or, you know, some embodied being. You know, they talk about we are God, that we live
cosmos.
In and the universe we live in. If you want to communicate with God, you know, connect with yourself. I mean, I guess there's some very Gnostic principles that follow in the same viewpoint. And so I think it's interesting that there's this belief that every religious tradition has this belief in a personification of it's this guy, you know, it's Zeus with the white hair and the lightning bolt and
right.
God with the beard and, you know, and Jesus with the cool yoga.
That reminds me of this really cool video that I'm in called God in the Box, too, because that has to do with everybody's impression of what is God? What does God look like to you? What does God sound like to you? But so, you know, I mean, like I said, if you're projecting or deriving a kind of a divine concept from your surroundings, then it becomes a very big concept. And by its very nature, the definition of God is omnipresence, right? So everything then becomes God. And then that becomes pantheistic. So everything starts to just kind of like become less defined. The lines aren't drawn. There's less divisiveness. It's more unifying to me. I appreciate it that way.
So. We did have another question. Yeah, we have time. From the chat room, and it was a little bit before, so I have to scroll back up. And this is from Purpose Focus EDU. It's the question says, it is said that the phoenix is the protector of an ancient library that housed sacred knowledge. What do you think of that?
Well, I like the idea of the phoenix, obviously. You know, this is a kind of a resurrection.
No, the sphinx. The sphinx.
Well, the sphinx. Oh, I thought you said the phoenix. Oh, yeah.
I might have. I don't know.
I talked to some people who claim to have been hanging around with Zahi Hawass, who's the antiquities director of in Egypt.
Well.
And they say that they had found some kind of doing ground penetrating radar, had found some kind of space room under, which is what the Edgar Cayce had claimed, that the, some kind of room underneath the Sphinx paw or something, and that that Zahi had like run off with this concept in his mind, and that there's something mysterious going on there, and possibly there were some things found there. But that, you know, that's a whole different subject, and that, and I'm not an expert on that particular area. But it doesn't surprise me. The Tibetans have texts hidden away. I mean, a lot of cultures have texts hidden away somewhere, and even what we do have from Egypt has is expressive enough. I mean, I don't even know what they could possibly add to the picture if they did find something hidden. It would have to be so extraordinary to be new to us, because Egypt has, like I said, if you start delving into their spiritual concepts and their religious ideas, they pretty much had it all. They covered everything. They were extremely detailed. So that wouldn't surprise me, no.
I think one of the sad pieces about religion, I mean, you know, my observation is that definitely Christianity is that it's supposed to be about love and kindness and turning your cheek and, you know, patience and non-judgment, and, you know, the list goes on and on and on and on and on. And sorry if you're Christian and you're listening to this, but sometimes they, you know, and I'm not saying everybody, but they don't follow their own rules.
Yeah, one of the things that had motivated me in writing The Christ Conspiracy to begin with was the destruction of culture and the, you know, the Inquisition and Catholicism, and then Protestants claiming that, well, we did a better job and so forth. But then you had not so pleasant experiences with fundamentalist Protestants as well. And I mean, it hasn't turned out the way. If there's a God or a Jesus in charge of what's happened in His name for the last 2,000 years, then He's responsible, and it's horrible what has happened in the name of Christianity, in the name of Jesus Christ.
God, quote unquote, isn't so nice. You know, He blows up cities and floods you. So God's not so nice. Jesus was supposed to be the nice one.
Yeah, and then we have people torturing for hundreds of years in His name. I mean, that didn't work out. You know, I mean, to me, this serves as evidence that this character is not real as being portrayed, because at any time, you know, when people were even, they were Christians too. There were whole swaths of Christians who were slaughtered by not just the Catholics, but powers that be. And at any time, Jesus could have stepped in and said, "Hey, whoa, wait a minute, stop killing all these people in my name." But it went on and on and on, and people were screaming in horror and torture. And even to this day, I mean, the smearing and the slandering and the libel and the just, the things that people have called me, and they make these ridiculous, retarded videos, just awful, despicable garbage, and they're spreading this around, full of slander against me. And you know, it just really not a very good display. I think that I've actually heard a Catholic priest some years ago talking, of all things, a Whole Life Expo. I'm standing there, and this guy comes up, and he says, "Hey, I think we should bring back the witch burnings." And I'm standing there just giving him the daggers, you know. I'm like, I can't believe this man is actually saying this. He's not the only one I've heard saying these things. That they, if they were allowed, they would just go run up and grab human beings off the streets and torture them to death. That's,
well, you know, I have ritual sacrifices in my backyard, you know, I'm burning at the stakes because, you know, that's just what I do. Well, no, and I brought that up because I thought it was interesting. There was a little not backstabbing, but some, like, little arguments going on even in the chat room as we're talking. I mean, not about what you and I were talking about, but just about the whole topic. And finally, I ended up posting something in there. It's like, you know, we are talking about the big JC. You know, we could at least be respectful.
Well,
please,
let's say that the calumny and vitriol are not good examples of Christian charity and love and what if we want to believe in a Christ figure, would this person be pleased by this behavior? Would he be proud of people doing this in his name? Is that the best we can do? This is no different than the diabolical cultures that supposedly existed before, where you're just going around attacking and vilifying and destroying and butting your nose into everybody else's business, too. There's a good one, too. I mean, the very notion that I have the right to seize you physically because you don't believe the same way I do and then put you to the rack or extort money out of you or just call you all kinds of hideous names, even though in your daily life you could be one of the most responsible, nicest people around. The simple fact that you do not have the same image in your brain as I do of divinity would give you the right to attack me and, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's unenlightened.
And, you know, and as you say that, it makes me think, you know, we have these issues about the religious jihadists in the Middle East, but when we were doing the Crusades, we were doing the exact same thing. We were trying to force our religious viewpoint on a group of people. Violent.
Of course, I wouldn't put myself in the category of we, but they, yes, they.
Well, but
I'm not part of that. I've never been part of that, but I know what you mean. Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that's true. Now we do have to deal with the same kind of nutterism that is that is going to try to restrict us in our thoughts and minds and deeds when we're not, like, you know, overtly breaking the law. And so one of the things I focus on to keep all that religious fanaticism at bay is that we have to take certain the United States Constitution I call my sacred scripture. We take that that is something that is inviolable. I mean, yes, it's a little bit outdated, it's, you know, some hundreds of years old, but the fact is that the rights that it guarantees us are sacred to me, and I will fight back with every ounce of my being to preserve those rights under that Constitution, under that sacred scripture, which, by the way, I talk about in another book called The Gospel According to Acharya S. So
well, and we have, just to let you know, we have about 3 minutes, maybe.
Okay.
So, I mean, you mentioned all these different books. So what, I mean, because we've been really, well, you know, the one I've been putting out there is The Christ Conspiracy, The Greatest Story of the Ever Sold. Christ Conspiracy, The Greatest Story Ever Sold. What other, you know, can you just kind of give us a rundown briefly about the other books that you have, you know, where people can get them, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. You can get all my books at either truthbeknown.com or stellarhousepublishing.com. The Christ Conspiracy, I followed that up with Sons of God, Krishna, Buddha, and Christ Unveiled, and that was addressing some of the criticisms of Christ Conspiracy. And that led to a pretty sizable book. Then I wrote Who is Jesus, Fingerprints of the Christ. I had people asking me, could you just address the issue of, like I said before, the Jesus Never Existed issue, which deals with just the New Testament, mostly just the canonical Gospels. And then I wrote, I've written lots of articles and, of course, e-books and so forth, but then I ended up, after this whole zeitgeist brouhaha, I ended up writing this massive book called Christ in Egypt, The Horus-Jesus Connection, which delved in very intensely. It's quite scholarly, and it's a hard read for some people, but it's got all the evidence in there. It's really quite solid and very well documented. And then this Gospel According to Acharya used to be online, and that's got some philosophizing in it. I think I present some interesting ideas to kind of more of a spiritual perspective than just tearing down religion or spirituality or mythology. And then I also published what's called the Astrotheology Calendar that has from ancient times celebrations on practically every day of the year, at least almost every day. But
especially December 25th.
Oh, yeah, there's some good stuff. I couldn't even fit it all in there. December's chock-a-block full of light celebrations. It's just wonderful. And then I've been working on and just released a book called Man-Made God by Barbara Walker, who's a fabulous author of women's spirituality and mythology and religion. But this book is designed to show how it is man who makes gods, and that I think it succeeds very well in that. So, excuse me. Those are the basic books rundown there that for what I offer at my site.
And that is truthbeknown.com, and I've posted in the webpage or on the chat room. It's also on the Just Energy Radio site webpage that they can get a direct link to your site.
Well,
I was going to just say the music's going to come up, but there it is. Acharya, thank you so much for sharing. I mean, you got all kinds of juice.
Well, I could go on for hours, so I appreciate all the time you've allotted me. Thank you very much.
Oh, not a problem. I mean, I knew that it would. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and we'll have to have you back.
I'd love to. Take
okay.
Care.
Thanks. Bye. And next week, we're going to be talking to Susan Shumsky about connecting with your immortal masters. But for those who missed it, here is the Mind Yoga Question of the Week. This group, which met in 325 AD, created a statement of beliefs which was used to define the course of beliefs of Christianity. And so, until next week, send your answer to justenergyradio@yahoo.com. And so, until next week, I'm Dr. Rita Louise. You've been listening to Just Energy Radio, marketing favorite, and be blessed.
Join host Dr. Rita Louise each week at this time for Just Energy Radio. Point your browser to www.justenergyradio.com for more show information and to contact Dr. Rita. Until next time, remember, it's all just energy.